is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me out, be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is Veronica Monet, and you are in the shame-free zone. We're getting a little bit of a late start this evening. I apologize that keep you waiting. We had a little technical difficulty. I had a little technical difficulty at my end. I'm very excited about tonight's guest. She happens to be the author of The Idiot's Guide to the Kama Sutra, and which has been really successful. It's actually in its second printing, and it's sold over 70,000 copies. I am very impressed. Her name is Johanina. I'm sorry, I said that first name too fast. Johanina Wyckoff, and she's a doctor. She's actually a psychologist. Is that true, Johanina?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, but you kind of bill yourself as non-traditional.
Well, I would say I'm eclectic, and probably most people who've been doing this work as long as I have, over 30 years, become innovative in the process, because one size, as you know, does not fit all. So in the service of helping people transform their sex lives and their relationships, I've explored a lot of territory, and I like to bring what I've learned really works to help people create successful relationships, fulfilling lives, to the work I do with them.
Well, you know, I think somatic psychology is actually starting to catch on, but you're rather unique in that you do mind-body relationship expert. So can you tell us a little bit more about the mind-body connection?
Sure. You know, somatic psychology, or what's also called body-mind psychology, has really been around for a very long time. Wilhelm Reich was a student of Sigmund Freud's. He was not a student, but a colleague. And what he did that was different in the course of therapy was that during analysis, he noticed that when people talked about certain things, or express certain emotions or didn't express certain emotions, their breathing patterns changed. And so he addressed people, in therapy, he addressed people through the breath. And one of the things that he noticed was that when people were fully expressed sexually, when they were orgasmic, they breathed in a particular way, fully, deeply, all the way through from their pelvis all the way up to their throat and their eyes. The breath moved, in other words. It wasn't blocked. And that when people were traumatized, sexually traumatized, or inhibited in some way because of some kind of trauma in their lives and they weren't fully expressed, the breath also was constricted. So that was really the birth of what we call somatics or body-mind therapy. And in the West, I would say in the West, you know, in the East there's always been an understanding of the connection between the body and the mind. From the yogic traditions, from in China, from Taoist practices, the understanding of energy and acupuncture. So the body-mind connection is certainly not new. But in the West, I think we can trace our roots back to Wilhelm Reich.
Well, you know, I didn't realize that the body-mind connection and that somatic psychology was really born out of the breath. So that's really quite interesting. I've been fascinated, actually, with the significance of breath. And, you know, it's the first thing we do when we're born, and it's the last thing we do when we die.
Yeah, really important. As the breath goes, so goes life.
And a lot of people don't know how to breathe, which seems kind of counterintuitive since we all have to breathe.
I think one of the things that happens is we do know how to breathe, but what happens in the course of our life when we experience trauma or we try to hold back our emotions, we also contract in our bodies and our breath. So we learn to hold our breath in order to suppress what we're feeling, and it's very effective. Unfortunately, when we learn to do that and we suppress our breath in order not to feel something uncomfortable, we also suppress our ability to experience pleasure and joy as well.
It's actually very similar to what I teach couples when I'm working with couples. I talk to them about, well, you know, if you've had an even a minor disagreement and decided, it's not worth a fight, I won't even bring it up, that there's a suppression of true emotion at that point. And if it happens enough over the course of, say, 10, 20, 30 years, you're going to wake up one day and find out you're not even attracted to your spouse anymore. And, you know, a lot of times I have to ask people, like, when's the last time you laughed so hard that it, you know, curled your toes?
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with the orgasms. It's just, you know, I think a habit, would you call it a habit? Or do you think that this is more about post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, I think that there are different reasons that people learn to suppress their emotions and therefore their capacity for pleasure and joy in their lives and connection. Certainly we know that people who have experienced trauma are affected, you know, whatever kind of trauma that is, it impacts the ability to feel and to be present, and it follows that that impacts our capacity for pleasure and joy and connection. But there are other factors as well. I mean, children learn to suppress their emotions because their emotions aren't validated. They're taught to, I mean, you know, generations of kids were taught to be seen and not heard. Or we learn very early that if we show up in our families in a certain way, we're not going to get loved for that, you know. So we're conditioned very early to become something other than what we really are, and to have the kind of fully expressed joy and pleasure in love and life and work and relationships, it's essential that we know who we are and we inhabit our own authenticity and bring that to our relationships. That's what makes life and relationships rich.
Well, how do people usually contact you when they're already, you know, way into crisis, or would you recommend that people actually be kind of preventative when it comes to getting help for their...
You know, research shows that people wait 7 years, couples wait 7 years from the time they first recognize their relationship is in difficult territory. And unfortunately, when a couple waits that long to come in, there's so much has accumulated that the work is really difficult. And I'm not saying it's impossible. Sometimes it is, but it's not always impossible. But so if people came in earlier, or if they did preventative I think particularly for couples, if couples did premarital or early relationship counseling, they would learn what they were getting into. Usually, you know, people are into the relationship a couple of years before they realize that they may be in a relationship with someone who has issues that are deal breakers for them. So, yeah, I think that premarital counseling is really valuable. And the people that I work with, the young people that I work with that are in their late 20s, early 30s, and are really beginning to look at their lives are exciting to work with because they're so open.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I don't know about what you've been in this business for a long time, but as a coach, it seems to me that there are more and more young people of that age group, late 20s, early 30s, seeking help instead of waiting until, you know, the relationship has died a natural death.
I think young people are coming into their lives, and the whole idea of coaching and therapy and personal growth has much less of a stigma than it did for earlier generations, where people were taught that you didn't go for help unless you were crazy. And, you know, there was a stigma for a long time that's somewhat dissolved, and people are getting help for all kinds of things. You know, we have coaches, we have coaches for our athletic practice, you know, and we have business coaches and life coaches and therapists and massage therapists, and we're much more apt to get help in our lives than we used to be.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that. Do you see older couples that have been married for 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, I do. That's one of the areas that I focused on is working with long-term couples.
And what
particularly in the area of sexuality, people who've been married for a long time have a whole different set of issues when it comes to their sexuality. First of all, they're older. And second of all, they've gone through several seasons of a relationship. And it's very, as you know from your own work, it's very common that people lose interest in sex. And many people, or people who that sex is important for, really want to look at whether, you know, how do you address that? What are your choices in dealing with sexuality in a long-term relationship? So that's one of the areas that I like to focus on with people.
I would love to talk about that because I think there's a lot of competing thoughts out there. I mean, you've got Christopher Ryan's book, you know, which basically asserts that we're not meant to be monogamous, and then of course you're going to get bored. Then you've got research around brain chemistry and hormones, which kind of lets us know that we're going to be in some kind of, you know, soup for the first 2 years of a relationship that really drive our sex drive towards each other, and then it tapers off after those 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's all kinds of industries, yours and mine included, that are really striving to help people rebirth that sex life, no matter how long they've been together. And I'm wondering, do you ever tell people they should just get a divorce? Or?
No, I never tell people they should just get a divorce. But people do come to that conclusion on their own sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't recognize divorce. I will say that I don't think that everyone should stay together, and I don't feel like my job is holding relationships together.
Uh-huh.
But I will do everything that I have in service of the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that's you, but it becomes a mission, doesn't it? I mean, it's especially if you can tell that they've ever felt any passion or love for each other. I have only rarely had a client who basically was never sexually attracted to their partner.
And yeah, that's a really difficult one, I find.
If
there's never been any chemistry, this is something I would actually like to ask you in your experience, because this has been something that's come up for me. I've worked with many couples who have had a lot of chemistry, a lot of great sex, and lost the desire over time.
Yeah.
We can talk about what happens to desire, but lost it, had it and lost it.
Yeah.
And have been able to reconnect with desire. But I haven't, in my experience, when a couple comes in and their marriage was never the attraction, they never had the chemistry there between them, I've never seen that really happen in a strong way.
I don't, there's so many complicated things around that, and I hate to throw my hands up on it, but I feel like this, as animals, we tend to respond very powerfully to pheromones. And if your partner hasn't even given off a smell that got you worked up when you didn't know about their character defects,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a real obstacle to try to get past,
mm-hmm.
And suddenly pull it out of thin air because you'll want it really bad, or you think it's the moral or right thing to do. I'm more likely to introduce some other options, like, okay, there's a long-term connection here that has great worth, but you don't have to source your sex with this person. As long as there's an honest arrangement between the two people, they could have their sex life somewhere else. And there's a lot of ways to do that. You can have an open marriage, or you can actually do polyamory where, everybody is fully informed about each other and you're creating, several long-term relationships simultaneously, in which case it takes pressure off of the relationship so that you don't have to try to make it a sexual one.
Mm-hmm.
And I know quite a few poly arrangements that work very well around that, because they have found that just as being family to each other, that has great value aside from the sexual connection. But
mm-hmm. What you're talking about is developing the relationship beyond the sexual connection.
Well,
the companionship, the partnering, the familial connection that doesn't center around a monogamous sexual relationship.
If that's indeed what they have, let's say a couple's been together for 20 years, the sex has never been good, they're not really, never have really been that excited about each other sexually, and they're at a point in their life where they'd really like to have some good sex while they still can, but they have no desire to leave this person. They love this person. They're happy with their day-to-day life with them. Then, yes, I think it would probably be a good idea to entertain the idea of having a sexual relationship somewhere else and maintain this beautiful friendship that's been going on for decades.
Do you find that those couples stay together? Or is polyamory, non-monogamy, open relationship a doorway out of the relationship?
Oh, God, no, it's not a doorway out. Certainly, for some people, it is, just as therapy can be a doorway out. I mean, statistically, mm-hmm. It's my understanding, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but by the time a couple seeks marriage counseling, they're probably more likely to get a divorce on the other end of that than stay together. So if you were doing a statistical analysis, you might almost be tempted to say that marriage counseling causes divorce. I don't believe that's the case. I think it's just that people wait so long that what they do is they get clarification about what they want, and then it winds up leading towards divorce.
Uh-huh.
So But, so some people may use polyamory or their assumptions about what polyamory is as kind of a band-aid for a really messed up relationship. And it's probably, you know, kind of doomed to fail from the get-go. But if polyamory is really something that's near and dear to their heart and they are practicing it as it meant, because polyamory is not open relationships and it's not promiscuity. It literally, the word means many loves. So that means you have to develop a larger capacity to connect and to care. And it actually requires a lot more communication, and a lot more negotiating and problem solving, and the sort of things most people try to avoid in relationships.
It's very time consuming.
Yes. Oh, but it's to me the rewards are immeasurable. My cousin just recently went through breast cancer treatment for breast cancer. She had to lose a breast, and she went through chemotherapy, and it was, you know, it's very, very life and death situation. But she has an extended family through polyamory, so she's still very connected to her ex-husband, and then she has several other people that she considers her lovers, or they have been lovers, and now they're friends, and you know, they share child care and life decisions about medical, housing. It's amazing. And what happened was that she ended up having this beautiful, you know, support through this incredibly traumatic thing. And instead of a partner being completely stressed out by, you know, the cancer, she had about six partners who took turns caring for her, took turns getting her to the doctor, and also did peer counseling for each other. So instead of bringing their grief and their fear to her, they took it to each other, supported each other, and then what they were able to do for her was just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually an article.
That sounds like a successful arrangement. But I will say that kind of support is available to people who have really close friendships that aren't necessarily sexual as well.
Well, see, poly oftentimes really does boil down to that, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's brief sexual connections that turn into more familial. So it's really up to the people that are involved. But, you know, originally we broached this topic because we were talking about couples who love each other and want to stay together but have never, ever had a good sex life.
Right.
And I wonder what your take on that is. Do you think the Kama Sutra could breathe life into a relationship that's never had chemistry?
First of all, let me just say a little bit about the Kama Sutra, because it's very interesting. It's a sex manual. It's the joy of sex, but think ancient India. Think 2,000
right.
years ago. And the Kama Sutra is, Kama means love, and Sutra is book, so it is the book of love, and it's about how to woo, court, win, seduce, and make love to a person, a man, a woman, various configurations. And I think that one of the things about the Kama Sutra that is so appealing is that it's really not judgmental. It has a lot of recommendations and a lot of advice about positions and how they work, and also moral practices that work and don't work, and yet it never shies away from describing those practices. Like, it doesn't recommend the multiple partners or triads or various arrangements other than marriage, but it also recognizes that people are going to do these things, so it goes into great detail about how to do them. So it has this real generosity to to it. It says, you know, we don't recommend this, we don't think it works, but, you know, here it is anyway. And I love that about the Kama Sutra. It has this kind of generous wisdom. So, if, you know, as far as people who don't have chemistry, I mean, one of the problems with people who don't have chemistry is they really don't make it a point to get naked with each other and try different things. I mean, they may in the beginning, or they may when they're young and they're hormonally driven and they really want to have sex because they still have their hormones driving them. But over time, over a long marriage where people go beyond their hormones, become postmenopausal and older, sex isn't hormonally driven. So so desire has to come from another place. And if you have a long history of unsatisfying sex and a lack of desire, your partner doesn't turn you on, you're going to be less likely to get naked with them and try different positions.
Absolutely. But let's say you have been turned on in the past, and you're telling us now mm-hmm. that the
different
hormone
story. Okay, different scenario. So
yeah.
So you're a couple, and you had you had good chemistry, you had good sex, and then you had kids, and then you had years of struggle of one kind or another, and now the kids are gone, and you're kind of looking at each other, and you're wondering, well, okay, what's left here for us, and can we find our way back? I'm still interested in sex. You say you're still interested in sex. How can we reconnect sexually? And I think at that point, where desire comes from in a long-established couple is it has to come from a different place. It has to come from feeling connected to this person in a new way. So if you and I have been bogged down in issues that make me feel like I don't want to get naked with you, or if I feel, more specifically, let's say we've become emotionally fused. I've given up a lot of what I wanted to do because you didn't like it. I haven't really been living my life. I feel kind of swallowed up in the relationship. You've withdrawn because of various ways that you feel like I treated you. But when those emotional issues are addressed in the relationship and people begin to take more responsibility for themselves and their own lives and bring that to the relationship, there's something starts to change. There's an opening. People start to see each other with fresh eyes. And that's where desire lives. It lives in the place of my being able to see you as the whole attractive, interesting person that I was attracted to in the first place. So I think the reawakening of desire in a long-established relationship pivots around seeing yourself in a new way, taking a stand for your own hard-won truth, being willing to live that in the relationship, stay connected to your partner, and bring that to each other. So it's a dynamic process that can happen in relationship to reawaken desire. And it's one of the challenges that I like a lot. And I will say that you know what you were saying about people coming in late and counseling producing divorce, I actually experience more people staying together than I do divorcing in
fabulous.
My practice.
Yeah. You're beating the odds, and that's great. But I just want to backtrack a little bit here, and it sounds like what you're saying, Dan, for a long-term relationship that's experiencing boredom in the bedroom, that rather, probably it's not a hormonal issue. Obviously, that's something that people can always verify with their doctor and check their testosterone levels. But that you're mostly suggesting that this is usually we're going to have to look at the emotional connection as opposed to the hormonal connection, which might have driven the sex life when they were younger. Is that true?
Yeah, you can't depend on your hormones to make you want to have sex once you've grown, for a woman, once you pass menopause, and for a man, there's a, you know, a gradual and sometimes a more rapid decline over a number of years. But yeah, desire has to come from the desire to connect, from a desire for in physical, emotional, spiritual intimacy with another person. And that cannot depend, that can't be driven by technique. Technique can't support that. Technique can enliven it. It can bring some new juice to it. But the deepest connection, the deepest intimacy comes when people reveal themselves to one another, when they feel the kind of safety and capacity to be vulnerable with one another, and sex is often reborn when a couple can get emotionally naked with one another, because that tenderness and openness paves the way to another kind of sexuality in a long-term relationship.
What do you tell people who are looking for the quick fix, like a testosterone patch or Viagra?
Well, you know, I think that we're fortunate that we have hormonal treatments and we have access to drugs like Viagra, because they can help us, but they can't fix us. And so if it's just an erection, then Viagra sometimes, often helps, not always, as you know. But desire isn't produced by taking a hormonal supplement or Viagra. Desire is a psychological, spiritual experience. It is actually one of our essential states. So when we're deeply connected with ourselves, to want is natural. I mean, we're born wanting life. If we kind of like I like to trace it all the way back. You know, I'm kind of a radical in a sense, but I like to go to the root of things. So with desire, if we look at, you know, if we go all the way back to the root of it, it was our desire for life. It's the desire for the egg and the sperm. You know, the egg actually, you know, we see it in the microscope. The egg actually opens up and reaches for the sperm as it approaches, kind of invites the sperm in. So we're fundamentally attuned to desire, and we lose that in our lives. We lose so much of ourselves, you know, in modern life. Modern life puts such a damper on our natural state. You know, when you talked earlier about our animal nature, our instincts, and our emotions, when we're in an authentic state, we're in touch with desire. Little babies, little children know desire. You take a 3-year-old to the supermarket and they go, I want this and I want that and I want this. And then the message is, it's not okay to want that. You're selfish, or we don't have the money, or, you know, we're humiliated for wanting. So we grow up with issues around desire. You know, the little baby says, I want that bowl of chocolate ice cream. But by the time you're 25, you're saying, oh, could I have a little bit, please? You know, we're taught to damp down desire. So
absolutely.
To reconnect with it and to become fully embodied in our desire, then we have access to passion and to energy and to sexuality if we want it forever. It's not. It doesn't depend on our hormones, but it, you know, it does depend on being able, feeling safe enough and good enough and connected enough and intimate enough to share that with someone that we want to share that with.
Well, now, what do you think it is that couples will avoid intimacy? Why is that?
Well, it's for a lot of people, it's dangerous. They don't want to feel the vulnerability that comes with intimacy. I have to be in intimacy. I'm seen. And that's a scary place because many people have been traumatized. They've experienced humiliation when they've been seen. They're hiding out in their lives. They don't want to be seen. And to be intimate means that you see me. And the longer we relate, in order to keep deepening our connection, I have to let you see more of me, more and more of me. And there's a part of us that wants that, and there's a part of us that fears that. We fear that we'll be shamed or humiliated or rejected or abandoned again. So we don't want to risk that much intimacy. A little bit, okay. You know, we can skim the surface of intimacy. This has been one of my concerns about polyamory and open relationships, is that it doesn't require people to get emotionally naked. I mean, I know in some ways it does, and I know that it's possible. But my concern is that it's also possible that people can deflect the need to be really vulnerable and intimate by having several partners. I know
it's
that's not always true, but
Johanina,
yeah.
I've seen it used both ways. Actually,
I'm sure.
You've seen people use polyamory to deepen their relationship skills, deepen their intimacy, and really just dive into relationships in a way that I very rarely see monogamous married people do. And then, of course, I've also seen people use polyamory to avoid their issues because, mm-hmm. you know, they don't even have to think that they're breaking up. They just kind of add another relationship and skate the surface forever and ever. So,
I think that ordinary monogamy or an unexamined monogamy can be deadening for people. But if people are truly committed to becoming, to use intimacy, to have their intimacy be a place where they contact themselves more deeply and fully and one another, then monogamy can be a place of awakening.
Well, and the same could be said for polyamory. I think monogamy, polyamory, marriage, you know, living together, so much of it is really about what the people involved, what their intentions are, and
mm-hmm.
and how deep they're willing to work issues. Because I personally think relationships are a spiritual journey. They are designed to help us grow and become better people.
Well, I'm glad that you're bringing that up because I think this is a recent development that people are looking at their relationships as both a school and an ashram, a place where we learn about ourselves and grow, and also a place where relationship becomes a practice. We bring our consciousness and our desire to be fully present and engaged compassionately, and that it actually becomes a practice.
I think this is
a new development.
Oh, absolutely. You go back to my grandparents' day. My grandmother, my father was the last of 11 kids, so my grandmother was pretty old for to be my grandmother. But she was born in 1899, and there was no this, oh, I'm not fulfilled, or, this relationship is not meeting my needs. They were just trying to raise 11 kids and you know, build a cabin in the...
Right, get the crops in.
The very idea, I'm sure she would think, would be hilarious. But, you know, that was how things were at that point. Marriage was, at one point, just about, you know, merging resources, economic resources, and surviving. And certainly at this point, we are in relationship not because we need to, but because we want to, because it, you know, accentuates our life in some way.
I remember my mother saying to me, your generation asks so much more of relationship than my generation. In my generation, we married because someone was a good man and he was going to take care of us and we could count on him. And in your generation, you're looking for emotional partners and people that you can work and play with and create and do, you know, go on retreats with.
Yes.
She said it's a tall order, and I think it's true. We are asking much more of relationship emotionally and spiritually, and probably and less for some people. I mean, you know, women today support themselves, so they're not looking to a man or to a partner to be their financial support. And they're also not willing to put up with some of the things that a woman who's emotional, who's financially dependent on a partner, will do.
No, it's true. It's true. Our tolerance for difficulty, and I think we need to cultivate a desire and an appetite for working the relationship so that we're not just looking for the quick fix and some kind of entertainment. It really bothers me when clients are kind of like just, you know, they want to get their needs met and that's it. They're not interested in investing in their growth in the context of their relationship.
I think it's a myth that relationships are supposed to meet our needs. I think that if we want to meet our needs, we're better off not getting into a committed relationship with another person because we will be vastly disappointed.
Well, I joke with women, but unfortunately it's not a joke. Statistics have shown that men who are single, of course, you know, get sick and die younger. So marriage is very good for men as far as longevity and health goes. And just the reverse is true for women. Women don't do so well when they're married.
Mm-hmm.
They actually live longer, healthier lives when they're single.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, I think it speaks volumes about the way marriage is being done, which takes a toll on women. They're kind of being used as maids, plus they're supposed to be out there getting an income. So they've just added more responsibility and work to their schedule, so it's not fair, but it's how it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you have some workshops coming up.
Yes,
I do. You've got a deeper intimacy salon in Petaluma. Can you tell us a little
bit about
that?
In Petaluma, yes. I am offering the first of an ongoing deeper intimacy salon on June the 9th here in Petaluma, and people can contact me or go to my website to find out more information.
And that website again is Johannina Wyckoff. Let's spell that for our listeners. It's Johanninawyckoff.com. JohannaWyckoff.com.
Yeah, so all the information is up there for the Deeper Intimacy Salon. And then on July 14th, I'm doing a women's workshop called Self-Ignited, which focuses on reawakening desire.
Oh.
That's a one-day workshop, also in Petaluma. And then I work with people privately.
Can you give us just a little taste of this woman's workshop, Self-Ignited? That's very intriguing. Is this like a masturbation workshop? Or
no, it's not. It's tracing the roots of desire and looking at your personal relationship to desire and how it lives in you, what happened to it in your particular life experience. It's not general, it's very particular to each person. And using the breath and some Reikian practices, learning the orgasmic reflex, which is a breathing and moving practice, and also some practices from the tantric lineages, and what I like to call an embodied inquiry. So not explicitly sexual, no nudity, but definitely exploring the psychological and spiritual roots of desire in yourself.
And
ways to move your energy, to work with your own energy.
Is this well suited for women who are menopausal?
I have women that the youngest woman is 28, and the oldest woman in this particular group at the moment is in her late 60s. So
wow.
It's a full range.
Okay. Well, it sounds fabulous. It really does. And I think there's kind of an epidemic of women either not having orgasms or not having desire, at least if you believe Oprah.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, I think it's true. I think that generations of women have not had good education about their bodies and their body's capacity for pleasure and how to access that. And I believe that mothers need to be teaching their daughters. And if a young woman learns about her body and her sexuality and pleasure from her mother, it's the greatest gift. I mean, you can learn it in other places, but when your mother teaches you about sensuality and the capacity of your body for pleasure, and also about love, and helps you, support you in knowing and making good choices about your sexuality, it's deeply empowering. It really is. I don't think, when we learn about sex from boyfriends, girlfriends, in school, it has a whole different it's much different. It's not as personal. It's not as easy to connect with. So, I feel very strongly about the educational component of pleasure.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, a couple of years back, Dr. Laura Berman was on the Oprah show recommending that mothers buy their daughters vibrators. And
I love that Oprah would put that on the air.
I know, wasn't it amazing?
That's very radical.
So some of the audience members were very concerned that this would actually create more sexual desire and that the teen daughters would be more likely to get sexually involved. And Dr. Laura Berman's whole premise was, if your daughter's had an orgasm, she doesn't need to let some clumsy 16-year-old get to her in the backseat of the car.
Right. Keep your girls off the street. Keep them at home with their vibrators. probably have a better orgasm with their vibrator than they would with an inexperienced young teenage boy.
I would think so. And, you know, it's, and then hopefully it was just, oh my God, I would think instead of all the times that girls out of curiosity or sexual frustration have engaged in sex that wasn't good for them with people that weren't good for them, it really could probably help mitigate that some. So, so tell us how we can find your book. I'm looking at the clock here. I realize we got about 3 minutes left. I want to make sure, again, that people know how they can reach you. And the name of the book
Guide to the Kama Sutra is available at Amazon. And, of course, you can ask your local bookstore to order it for you.
Right.
And you can find out about the work that I do. I do private sessions and also intensives for individuals and couples who come from a distance, and the Deeper Intimacy Salon and the Self-Ignited Workshop for Women on, at my website, johanninawyckoff.com. And, yeah, I'd love to hear from people, and if you have any thoughts about our conversation, love to hear from you.
Wonderful. And those intensives for couples when they're coming from a distance, is that like an afternoon, a day, 2 days?
People come and we'll spend sometimes an afternoon, the minimum, well, a session is an hour or 2 hours. An intensive becomes 3 hours or longer, and when people come at a distance or a couple comes or an individual comes for one or more days, we do 2 3-hour sessions each day. And
wow.
I live in the wine country of County, so there's lots of beautiful places to be in nature and good food and lovely lodgings where you can be when you're not in session.
It's true. You're not far from Napa and Calistoga. So,
Yeah,
right. Beautiful. Okay, well, again, I thank you so much for joining me in the Shame Free Zone. I really resonated with a lot of your material. I just love the idea that you are helping people get their focus off of those pills and potions and onto their emotions.
Great. Thanks, Veronica. Really lovely to speak with you.
Thank you, Dr. Wyckoff. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate it. And to my listeners, again, I'm very sorry we got a late start here. I'm so glad that Dr. Wyckoff was still available and just, you know, being a very good sport. So that's awesome. And be sure and check in next Monday when I guarantee you the Shame Free Zone will kick in at its regular time at 9 p.m. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mentus kabar berita?